The Jazz Portraits.
Hi, I'm Reedy Rosness, and it's a special treat for me to host this series because I have the opportunity to sit down and talk with musicians who've been personal heroes of mine for many years. Some of the greatest names in Canadian jazz.
Joe Seeley.
Guido Basso.
Don Thompson.
Paul Play.
Terry Clark.
Oliver Jones.
When free jazz was born, one of the presiding doctors in the musical delivery room is my guest today. A pianist who began his career in Montreal, he moved to the United States in 1950. He's released nearly 100 recordings and has performed with many of the major jazz artists of the past half century. Today's jazz portrait, Paul Blay.
Writing is a dirty word. Written music is a coffin of ideas. What do you play if you don't have written music? You play the environment, you play the moment. You just play the room, play the night. Planning is a dirty word.
Kind of like written music's a dirty word,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you're assuming, you know, the audience has the luxury of not knowing what's coming. And why would you deny yourself that luxury as the performer?
You grew up in Montreal in the 1940s. Do you remember the first time that you heard jazz music?
Yes, exactly. I'm Jewish. And in the bar mitzvah, the rabbi says, you're going to now do the celebration of the bar mitzvah. And he gives me a script, and you're supposed to read the script. And he says, now you have to sing it. I said, what do you mean sing it? Where's the melody? Where's the written music? He says, you have to make it up. And that was a turning point in my life because I've been making it up ever since, without a script, musically.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you?
13, that's the bar mitzvah age. It's exactly, I know the date exactly, the day of my birthday, November 10, at the age of 13.
So prior to that, had you been improvising on the piano?
Well, prior to that, I took piano lessons, which is all written music, which
right.
is a fiction, because written music is very metrical, and we don't talk metrically. As a matter of fact, I'd like to try that sometime. What is metrical talking like? I guess it would be robotic.
Did you find that playing by ear was just kind of effortless for you?
Yes, I've copied records in my mind. So, I mean, I could do the entire Woody Herman big band on the piano.
Right.
That was my goal, was to sound like 16, including Pete Condoli, who wore a Superman suit with a cape as the high note guy, the climax of the musical evening.
Right.
I've never taken up the cape because it creates an identity crisis.
Well, there's still time.
With a big S on your...
You'll have to have a big P on it, I think.
Right, which is its own problem.
So the Woody Herman bands that, the music that you heard, what, was it on the radio or did your parents?
No, I owned them. I bought all the records.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
So you sought out jazz music then?
It found me. I just liked it and became an avid fan.
By the time you were 14, you had your own bands in Montreal, and you called yourself Buzzy Blay. How did you come up with that name?
Well, there was a cartoon character in the comics called Buzzy. He had a shock of blonde hair, and he played the trumpet. Now, before I was committed myself to piano, I made sure to take photos with every instrument. So I have a photo with me holding an alto sax, a tenor sax, a trumpet, and so forth. And turned out that trumpet was very difficult to play. So I kept the name, though, for a while.
Uh-huh.
Bussy Blade. I had bandstands in Montreal with B, lighted bandstands. Maynard Ferguson was my idol at the time.
I saw photographs of those particular music stands you referred
wow,
to.
Oh, I'd love to see a photo.
And you also played the violin for many, many years,
well,
although it didn't seem like
you... Let's put it this way.
I also did.
Did you?
Yeah.
See, we're both guilty as charged.
You were only 17 when you took over from Oscar Peterson at the Alberta Lounge in Montreal when he went to the States to play with jazz at the Philharmonic. You then went to New York to study at Juilliard and soon made your first recording with Charlie Mingus and Art Blakey in 1953. You were very young, 21 years old.
Oh, I don't know biography.
But there you were in the studio with Art Blakey and Mingus.
I have a famous story about that that nobody knows. See, the problem, every bandstand is one or more serious problems that have to be overcome. Playing good is not the problem. Serious problems are the ones that will defeat the entire enterprise of the performance. For instance, in Blakey's case, if you had heard him and understood his playing, you'd find out that he got a little louder every chorus. So he'd start off 4-4 cymbal, really nice and relaxed. And you figure, boy, I can do this. I can be heard. Wrong. He gets a little louder on the second time around, the third time, but a fifth time. Now he's going ding, ting, a ling, ting. You know, it's getting louder and louder.
Right.
And louder. So he's going to steamroll right over the pianist. And being a young pianist, I qualify for being steamrolled. So here I am in a dilemma. I will be the only inaudible musician on that record date. So what I invented on the spot a technique, which is I put the shoulder forward like a hipster playing the piano and didn't play. So they had to lean in to see, where's the piano? I don't hear the pianist. He looks like he's playing. He's got that hip stance ready to go. But I don't seem to hear him. I better quieten down a little bit. Maybe he'll come through. And I kept control of the volume of the date. Every time they'd rise in level, I did the shoulder on them, and they'd have to come down. I can't hear him. Let's better quieten down and see what he's doing. So it was a physical thing, like mime.
Mm-hmm.
I mimed the
mm-hmm.
first day.
Very clever. A couple of years after that recording, you got a call from Chet Baker?
Chet was very funny. I said, you know, Chet, I really want to thank you so very much because it was winter in Manhattan. It was snowing, it was blizzardy and all that. And you called me from Los Angeles, invited me to come out to California and to join his band for a tour. And there were Hollywood actresses on every three of the walls, lined up on the walls, because Chet was the perfect movie star.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Chet, I really am grateful for you for giving me that call. And then he paused for a while and said, you called me. Which sounds right. Why would he call me? He's in Los Angeles. There's nothing but pianists coming out of the woodwork. I must have called him. and asked him to invite me to go to Los Angeles to play with him.
Well, it worked.
It was worked, but I've believed this fiction for a few decades.
After that, you did quite a bit of touring and ended up out west. What was the experience that you had during a concert at the home of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz?
Lucille Ball, she's a saint, by the way. It saved my life, really, in a sense. I was just doing a one-nighter, happened to be New Year's Eve at her country club home in Southern California. So I collapsed on the bandstand. I had done an extensive tour of the United States, and this was the final performance. Mm-hmm. And
you really had a drive. Sorry to interrupt you, but it seems like you just were working all the time.
I was good at it, and that was one of the liabilities. If you're good at getting gigs, it doesn't tell you how good you play. You may have gotten the gig because you're good at getting gigs.
Might have nothing to do with the music.
Yeah, it could be a false indicator. They hired you because you had a car instead of how you played.
Right.
Success is not an indicator of anything except the gift of gab.
So that evening you ended up in the hospital.
Yeah, Lucy said, I said, Lucy, I'm going to be okay. Just put me on the couch. She said, no. She called, she said, I'm taking you to the hospital right now. Palm Springs Hospital, purple skies. It's the best hotel I was ever at. And they found a pencil dot, which indicated an ulcer, but it was only a pencil dot. But I was weak because the pencil dot was losing fluid, losing blood.
Dangerous.
Yeah. But she insisted, no, you're staying here as my guest. I was there for a week, and then she sent me to La Jolla, California for further tests. I mean,
another beautiful place.
It was somebody who just walked in the door to play the piano on New Year's Eve. And she took great care of me.
What really happened that night in terms of perhaps the direction of your music or direction of how you were going to live your life? That did you really have an epiphany?
Oh, absolutely. It changed the order of priorities. I mean, when I fell off the stool backwards, I realized that there was only one thing I wanted, which was to be able to, after being hospitalized at her request, the only thing I wanted was to be able to leave the hospital room and on my own steam.
Mm-hmm.
And that negated all my ambitions for success. Hmm. Prior to that time, I had the same ambition as a box of Kellogg's cornflakes. I wanted everybody to know what it was and where it was and that I was part of it and so forth. I had a universal ambition. Well, the focus got very narrow after that. All I wanted to do was to be able to leave the building under my own steam. That would satisfy all my ambitions financially, emotionally, career-wise, etc. They just went, if you let me walk out of this room in my own steam, I'll be happy.
Right.
I'll be content.
Got down to the basic necessities of life.
Right.
And how did that affect your music?
Well, I certainly didn't care about money or career or fame in particular.
Mm-hmm. After you got out of the hospital, you played for over a year at the Hillcrest Club in Los Angeles with Charlie Hayden.
My bass player, Hal Gaylor from Montreal, went back home, and I had an open audition at the Hillcrest Club. I need a bass player. I had a bunch of guys come in. Some guys had good time and lousy notes. Some guys had good notes and lousy time. Charlie had great time and no notes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, wait a minute. Notes are easy. It's just music education. Having good time is a natural inbred talent. So I said, well, we can work on that. My band was there for a year, so notes were no problem in a year.
Your drummer, Billy Higgins, had some friends, and he asked you about whether they could come down and play.
Right.
And it seemed like that was maybe a revelation.
Well, it was unusual because we didn't welcome guests, and there was no reason to bring a guest because there was a guest night, the off night. So he said, we've got a couple guys now. Do you want us to sit in? I said, yeah, it's okay with me. You know, and they got up on the bandstand, and what was it they were doing? They didn't play conventional pitch. It was microtonal. And that was the good news. Microtonal? I play piano. You have to break a note to get it to be microtonal.
So those two musicians we were speaking of were Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry.
Correct. So, I mean, there was a skill set from the very first sounds that quartet made mm-hmm. that I was totally unfamiliar with, but had been secretly seeking to advance my skill sets. When you talk about microtonal for a pianist, I mean, what's the question?
Mm-hmm.
It's all questions with no answers.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you felt at the piano when they were playing, in terms of how you approached what you were doing and how it was different from what you might have been doing before?
Every piece they played during the sound check and the rehearsal was new material, new information that I had not previously experienced.
Written down stuff or free?
Writing is a dirty word. We don't use it. If it's written, it's written music is a coffin of ideas. So, yeah, every tune required a new skill set, different from the tune before it, and certainly all different from any experience I had.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was, we played every night, six nights, and each tune was a new skill set. Seemingly endless. I mean, we rehearsed every day, so we added 20 pieces to the repertoire mm-hmm. on Tuesday, and then there was Wednesday.
So you added these two musicians to your group. How did that go over in the club?
We were a big success until we hired Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman. After hearing the first set, at the time I was with Carla Bley. I went out in the backyard with Carla and said, the question is, if we hire these guys, we're going to be fired and be out of here in a week. We've been here for years.
Right.
So what should we do? And without batting an eyelash, Carla said, we have to hire these guys.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of the fact that we realized our demise was imminent.
When Ornette and Don joined the band, the audiences...
Right, it was famous. When you were driving along Washington Boulevard, approaching the area of the club, you always knew when the band was on the stage because the streets were full of people who had taken their drinks outside And they loved the club, so the moment the music stopped, they would come back in the club with their own drinks.
Wasn't that a little disconcerting, or how did the band feel about that?
Nobody cared.
Nobody cared.
Nobody cared.
You guys were having fun.
Well, we were, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I like difficult jobs.
To just say one thing about a recording that you did with Sonny Rollins, Sonny Me Talk, and your solo on All the Things You Are. It's just, it sounds so fresh to me, even today. You know, your music is, your approach was so melodic, and yet it was atonal. It was very surprising. There's a lot of maybe danger in the way you were approaching the improvisation. And how did you get to that? How did you develop that kind of thinking?
I had a lot of help. Don Cherry, for instance, could play slower than the time, faster than the time, or right on the time. You had three choices in every phrase. So not only did you have to play the phrase that you wanted to play, but you could play it, speed it up slightly or slow it down. And I mean seriously ignore the time that the tune was in at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So you had three options to start with, just from a point of view of a tempo.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody's, normally you're trying to swing. Every rock musician plays in time really well, so being a swinging pianist is almost a liability. You're pretending it's difficult to do. If deaf guitar players can do it, what does it mean? Not much. But that was one of the skill sets, being able to play faster and slower than the time, at any time. And that particular track you referred to with Rollins indicates that. You could not
a lot of elasticity.
Exactly. And to be able to switch between slower to faster to normal at any point, and do two or three times, three things in the space of what you would normally do once,
right.
one crack at. So that elasticity, it's a nice word, thank you for the word, elasticity.
Johnny also sounded like he was stretching for himself, too, during that period.
I'll tell you a Sonny Rollins story. The call came out in New York. Herbie Hancock and I were invited to Birdland to sit in with the purpose of joining Miles's band and Sonny's band, because it was so long ago that Birdland needed two bands on a Monday night, the Sonny Rollins band and the Miles Davis band. So Herbie and I showed up, and Herbie said in the dressing room, he said, "Paul, which gig would you like?" I said, "Wow, I would never have offered him first choice. What a gentleman."
It wasn't tongue-in-cheek?
No. This is playing for keeps. Yeah. These guys, this was going to be decided that night.
Right.
At the end of the night, he would go with one band, I would go with another, and he's offering me first choice? Wow, what a gentleman. He said, "Which one do you want?" I said, "Herbie, give me a moment to think. I'll go up on the bandstand and play a tune with Sonny," because he was next on the line. "And when I come off, I'll tell you which gig I want, Sonny Rollins or Miles Davis. What a problem."
Wow.
So I went in the bandstand.
We should all have such problems.
Yeah, really. All right, so now I go in the bandstand, and it's my wand. You know, I'm an iconoclast, so I was going to throw the kitchen sink at him and the stove and the kitchen table. "Sonny, you ready? Okay, bow, bow, bow. You won't even know what room we're in. I'm going to make it a point to fail and take you down with me."
But he's the prize fighter, right?
Well, he's a prize fighter. You got to watch. When it looks like you're doing well, be careful. The knockout is only around the corner. You'll be on the floor looking up saying, "What happened?"
Right.
So I did throw the kitchen sink at him, you know, and he jumped to the bait, and he was throwing the kitchen sink at me, and the sparks were flying, and I'm having a wonderful time. Very adversarial.
Uh-huh.
Well, I came up to bandstand, and he offered me the gig and go to Japan with him and so forth. Nuke Rollins.
I read in an interview once that that you said destruction is one of the main tools of improvisation.
Well, it's just like a school blackboard. After a certain point, the blackboard's full. You have to erase if you're going to continue writing things on the blackboard.
Right.
So there's phrases in which you're adding to the information, and then you have to erase before you can add more because you've filled up the board.
Right. Editing.
No, it's worse than editing. You actually have to erase what happened before. That takes courage.
And the erasing is destructive?
It's half the job. Hmm. The board only holds so much information.
Mm-hmm.
So erasure is at least half the process. So you play things that you're making statements in, and then you play things that are non-statement-like. They're just for the purpose of making you forget what you heard so far. Beauty, for instance, if you keep adding to beauty, it becomes saccharine.
Right.
So you can't stay
beautiful.
You need
the yin and the yang.
Well, that's too general. I'd like specifically saying that you have to do the opposite.
Right.
human beings, you know, if you study the audience as a beast, a wild beast that can be destructive and destroy you, like a bullfighter, you know, you have to, when the gig is over, you have to still be alive.
Or so a comedian, a stand-up comedian.
Well, that's the hardest gig in the world, unless you're married.
I'll leave that one alone.
We'll save that for the anchor.
George Russell, he wrote a two-piano piece for an orchestra. And you
Jazz
were...
Jazz in the Space Age.
That's right.
On Decca.
And you were one of the pianists, and the other pianist was Bill Evans. And I love the idea that you were anxious to, quote-unquote, I'm quoting you, throw the kitchen sink at him.
It was my norm, but I was very surprised because Jazz in the Space Age by George Russell has a lot of written music in it, but then there's a lot of passages of free improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
They alternate. And so now I'm going to play with Bill for the first time.
Was he an idol of yours?
No, I mean, it was a monster. Bill was a monster. So I memorized the music, but not just in terms of being able to play the notes right. I was the music.
Mm-hmm.
If you are the music, you can't play it wrong. So I had the piece down. Well, now the date starts, and I play the opening phrase. And I was trying to do my best phrases as, see if you can handle this curveball. And he plays it back better than I did. I said, wait a minute, it's my phrase. And he kept doing that. He kept
so verbatim, you would play something and he would just play
it back, but better. More taste, more subtle, better touch. I said, wait a minute, you know, he's playing my stuff better than I'm playing it. That's not fair. I didn't count on this. On top of it, nobody told me he was going to play that good. This is the world's best jazz pianist. I mean, it was unanimous. Everybody loved Bill Evans.
Everybody digs Bill Evans.
Everybody loved him. And
yeah.
He played better than everybody. There's a reason he got the chair with Miles, because there was nobody else could do that gig. He was the monster.
Right.
Even though I turned that gig down. All right, so now it's opportunity number two. Thank you. Well, now the orchestra comes in, and it was right up there all the time. And I hate it when somebody plays better than me. I really hate it.
You should love it.
No, it's adversarial. I mean, I'm supposed to be the better player. I mean, I've got something to win. He already owns all of jazz piano literature to the time, you know, since Stride died. Well, we chased each other around like that, and so he was opening at the Village. The record theater was on a Saturday. He was opening at the Village Vanguard on the following Monday. So I said, I gotta go to the Village Vanguard and see if he's playing my stuff, because he played my stuff better than I did, but it was my stuff. So I show up at the Village Vanguard, come out through the back door, and he's standing against the wall, very low key guy, you know. So I said, I wait to hear the first set. And he's playing Someday. I said, wow, I'm saved.
You thought all your secrets were going to be out.
No, he was doing the standard Bill Evans stuff that we all grew and loved. But, I mean, it was we expected that. And so now the only clue I had of his response was, he finished the set, he comes off backstage. And, you know, Bill is very soft-spoken and very low-key, so he cracks and makes a comment about the record date we did and about what he's playing and all of that. I mean, he's going to be informative now about, to me, it was a mystery. How come he didn't bring the kitchen sink to the Village Vanguard and erase the need for me to exist as a musician? Because if he plays my stuff better, that implies that I'm out of a job from now on. So he whispers very quietly to me. He says, "Paul, what was it that we did at that record date?" Now, being a Juilliard graduate, I could have spoken for an hour on the subject, you know. But Carla taught me that the less you say, the better it is. So I said, "I did a Lester Young on him." I said, "Slipping and Sliding." And he looked at me for a moment, hoping that I might continue, and I resisted the impulse to speak, and he went past it and never asked that question again.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a moment when he was asking for help. Now, in the art world, help is a non-starter. So he was adversarial, as far as I'm concerned. You know, he was my biggest nightmare.
Your solo career, at some point you decided that you were going to dispense with any kind of written music.
It wasn't a line in the sand.
No.
It was a skill set that I gradually adopted, which was easier than forgetting the sheet music or the scores at the airport. You never lost music because you didn't bring it to begin with.
Right.
It's very luxury. When you're on the road, you don't, you know, you vision, I grow old, I grow old, I walk on the shore with my trousers rolled, a nice image. And not having to carry any music, not having to rehearse,
right?
Not having to play well. These are all freedoms that take years to acquire.
Is it somewhat similar to kind of learning how to draw like a child?
Yes, that's a good analogy.
Take away all the preconceived notions and get to the essence of it.
Well, if you practice how to fail, you'll succeed.
Well, I'll have to try that.
It's not a hard thing to do. I'd like to propose an idea which I find radical about. It's not enough to play good. You're supposed to play good and bad. That's a form of keeping the audience awake. How do you know where the good parts are unless there's some bad parts that precede it?
When you sit down to play solo piano, do you feel that you connect to a certain muse?
Well, there is no piano. That's another construct, if you excuse my repetition. There is no piano. If you admit to the fact that it's a piano, then you have to say all the conservatories and all the King's Men won't put Humpty Dumpty back together again, etc., etc. No, there isn't a piano. There's a box with strings. And it's not very kind, and it has no presets. Make of it what you will. If you think it's a piano, you've already limited what you're going to do in the near future.
But that's assuming that you have preconceived notions about what you should do because it's a piano.
Exactly, exactly. You don't want those preconceived notions because somebody else who's been dead for 300 years has made those decisions before you, and you don't need to go there.
Right, so you throw all that to the wind.
You just ignore it as if it doesn't exist.
One thing I love about your playing is not only the word I used before, the elasticity of it, but also the range. I mean, you really use the entire piano in and out. I mean, and you're not afraid of space. Would you consider yourself a minimalist?
Can you say that faster?
I can't. It's not possible.
A minimalist.
Yeah.
Well, when I bought a Japanese car, a Maxima, and I said, "Well, I used to have a Minima, and now I'm graduating to the Maxima."
I think for many of the greatest players, yourself included, what I hear is the process of discovery going on in real time. And that's what's exciting. And that's what touches me. And for me, anyway, it doesn't necessarily have to do with how accomplished technically somebody is. It's whether or not what they have to say can be translated musically. And I think the audience will embrace that because you can't fool people in general.
You know, the audience has the luxury of not knowing what's coming. And why would you deny yourself that luxury as the performer? You're playing that piano in that room on that night in that weather condition at that biographical moment of yourself.
And with that particular audience, too.
That particular audience, which is the whole story. So, I mean, all these givens, you can come to the gig without any presets at all. You don't have to be inspired. You don't have to play well. You know, you just play the room, play the night, mm-hmm. play your biography, what didn't happen the previous night. I mean, there's so many givens.
Play your emotions.
I say, what do you play if you don't have written music? That's what you play. You play the environment. You play the moment. And there's one little hidden agenda that a musician wants to do, and they want to be able to leave the stage with something that they've learned how to do in real time at that moment that they couldn't do before the performance started. Mm-hmm. So what am I going to get done tonight?
Right. It's like Miles Davis saying to his band, I pay you to practice on the bandstand.
That's nice.
Well, you turned 75 coming up this year.
Remember, 75 is 57. Exactly.
And why should I remember that?
Well, don't take everything at face value. Depending, if you're Hebrew, you will read backwards, it will be 57.
So what are your thoughts on where the music is today or where it's going?
Well, of course, the rule of thumb that underlies all questions like that is that how do you know when you're on the right path that things are changing? And the joke is that you'll always know what's next in jazz because you won't like it.
You won't like it. Are you saying that you're you anticipate that?
No, I don't mean me particularly, the listener. This is just for the lay person. You can tell how modern it is by the fact that you'll be disapproving. But that's a joke. And first of all, the difficulties that are claimed are exaggerated. It's really quite simple. Nobody plays good. If you have one free hand with five fingers on it, you've got too many options. So it's what you don't play that really counts.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much for your time, and it was a great pleasure speaking with you. And on this rainy day in New York, I'm glad you made it here dry and in one piece. And it's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Renee.